This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Halo, The Fall of Reach by Eric Nyland. Read by Todd McLaren.
Prologue. 0500 hours, February 12th, 2535, military calendar. Lambda Serpentis system, Jericho 7, theater of operations. Contact. All teams stand by. Enemy contact my position. The chief knew there were probably more than 100 of them. Motion sensors were off the scale. He wanted to see them for himself, though. His training made that lesson clear. Machines break. Eyes don't. The four Spartans that composed Blue Team covered his back, standing absolutely silent and immobile in their Mjolnir combat armor. Someone had once commented that they looked like Greek war gods in the armor, but his Spartans were far more effective and ruthless than Homer's gods had ever been. He snaked the fiber-optic probe up and over the 3-meter-high stone ridge. When it was in place, the chief linked it to his helmet's heads-up display. On the other side, he saw a valley with eroded rock walls and a river meandering through it, and camped along the banks as far as he could see were grunts. The Covenant used these stocky aliens as cannon fodder. They stood a meter tall and wore armored environment suits that replicated the atmosphere of their frozen homeworld. They reminded the chief of biped dogs, not only in appearance, but because their speech, even with the new translation software, was an odd combination of high-pitched squeals, guttural barks, and growls. They were about as smart as dogs, too, but what they lacked in brain power, they made up for in sheer tenacity. He had seen them hurl themselves at their enemies until the ground was piled high with their corpses, and their opponents had depleted their ammunition. These grunts were unusually well-armed. Needlers, plasma pistols, and there were 4 stationary plasma cannons. Those could be a problem. One other problem. There were easily 1,000 of them. This operation had to go off without a hitch. Blue Team's mission was to draw out the Covenant rear guard and let Red Team slip through in the confusion. The chief detached the optics and took a step back from the rock wall. He passed the tactical information along to his team over a secure comm channel.
4 of us, Blue 2 whispered over the link. And 1,000 of them? Piss poor odds for the little guys.
Blue 2, the chief said, I want you up with those jackhammer launchers. Take out the cannons and soften the rest of them. Blue 3 and 5, you follow me up. We're on crowd control. Blue 4, you get the welcome mat ready. Understood?
4 blue lights winked on his heads-up display as his team acknowledged the orders.
On my mark, the chief crouched and readied himself. Mark!
Blue 2 leaped gracefully atop the ridge, 3 meters straight up. There was no sound as the half-ton of Mjolnir armor and Spartan landed on the limestone. She hefted one launcher and ran along the ridge. She was the fastest Spartan on the chief's team. He was confident those grunts wouldn't be able to track her for the 3 seconds she'd be exposed. In quick succession, Blue 2 emptied both of the jackhammer's tubes, dropped one launcher, and then fired the other rockets just as fast. The shells streaked into the grunts' formation and detonated. One of the stationary guns flipped over, engulfed in the blast, and the gunner was flung to the ground. She ditched the launcher, jumped down, rolled once, and was back on her feet, running at top speed to the fallback point. The chief, Blue 3, and Blue 5 leapt to the top of the ridge. The chief switched to infrared to cut through the clouds of dust and propellant exhaust just in time to see the second salvo of jackhammers strike their targets. 2 consecutive blossoms of flash, fire and thunder decimated the front ranks of the grunt guards, and most importantly, turned the last of the plasma cannons into smoldering wreckage. The chief and the others opened fire with their MA-5B assault rifles, a full automatic spray of 15 rounds per second. Armor-piercing bullets tore into the aliens, breaching their environment suits and sparking the methane tanks they carried. Gouts of flame traced wild arcs as the wounded grunts ran in confusion and pain. Finally, the grunts realized what was happening and where this attack was coming from. They regrouped and charged en masse. An earthquake vibration coursed through the ground and shook the porous stone beneath the chief's boots. The three Spartans exhausted their AP clips and then, in unison, switched to shredder rounds. They fired into the tide of creatures as they surged forward. Line after line of them dropped. Scores more just trampled their fallen comrades. Explosive needles bounced off the chief's armor, detonating as they hit the ground. He saw the flash of a plasma bolt, sidestepped, and heard the air crackled where he had stood a split second before. "Inbound Covenant air support," Blue Four reported over the comlink. "ETA is 2 minutes, Chief."
"Roger that," he said. "Blue Three and Five maintain fire for 5 seconds, then fall back. Mark."
Their status lights winked once, acknowledging his order. The grunts were 3 meters from the wall. The chief tossed 2 grenades. He, Blue Three and Blue Five, stepped backward off the ridge, landed, spun, and ran. 2 dull thumps reverberated through the ground. The squeals and barks of the incoming grunts, however, drowned out the noise of the exploding grenades. The chief and his team sprinted up the half-kilometer sandstone slope in 32 seconds flat. The hill ended abruptly, a sheer drop of 200 meters straight into the ocean. Blue Four's voice crackled over the comm channel.
"Welcome mat is laid out, Chief. Ready when you are."
The grunts looked like a living carpet of steel-blue skin, claws, and chrome weapons. Some ran on all fours up the slope. They barked and howled, baying for the Spartans' blood.
"Roll out the carpet," the chief told Blue Four. The hill exploded. Plumes of pulverized sandstone and fire and smoke hurtled skyward.
The Spartans had buried a spiderweb pattern of Lotus anti-tank mines earlier that morning. Sand and bits of metal pinged off of the chief's helmet. The chief and his team opened fire again, picking off the remaining grunts that were still alive and struggling to stand. His motion detector flashed a warning. They were incoming projectiles high at 2 o'clock, velocities at over 100 kilometers per hour. 5 Covenant Banshee flyers appeared over the ridge.
"New contacts. All teams open fire," he barked.
The Spartans, without hesitation, fired on the alien flyers. Bullet hits pinged from the flyers' chitinous armor. It would take a very lucky shot to take out the anti-grav pods on the end of the craft's stubby meter-long wings. The fire got the aliens' attention, however. Lances of fire slashed from the Banshee's gun ports. The chief dove and rolled to his feet. Sandstone exploded where he had stood only an instant before. Globules of molten glass sprayed the Spartans. The Banshees screamed over their heads, then banked sharply for another pass.
"Blue Three, Blue Five, Theta Maneuver," the chief called out.
Blue Three and Five gave him the thumbs-up signal. They regrouped at the edge of the cliff and clipped onto the steel cables that dangled down the length of the rock wall.
"Did you set up the foe gases with fire or shrapnel?" the chief asked.
"Both," Blue Three replied.
"Good." The chief grabbed the detonators. "Cover me."
The foe gases were never meant to take down flying targets. The Spartans had put them there to mop up the grunts. In the field, though, you had to improvise. Another tenet of their training, adapt or die. The Banshees formed into a flying V and swooped toward them, almost brushing the ground.
The Spartans opened fire.
Bolts of superheated plasma from the Banshees punctuated the air. The chief dodged to the right, then to the left. He ducked. Their aim was getting better. The Banshees were 100 meters away, then 50 meters. Their plasma weapons might recycle fast enough to get another shot, and at this range, the chief wouldn't be dodging. The Spartans jumped backward off the cliff, guns still blazing. The chief jumped too, and hit the detonators. The 10 Fogasses, each a steel barrel filled with napalm and spent AP and shredder casings, had been buried a few meters from the edge of the cliff, their mouths angled up at 30 degrees. When the grenades at the bottom of the barrels exploded, it made one hell of a barbecue out of anything that got in their way. The Spartans slammed into the side of the cliff. The steel cables they were attached to twanged taut. A wave of heat and pressure washed over them. A heartbeat later, 5 flaming banshees hurtled over their heads, leaving thick trails of black smoke as they arced into the water. They splashed down, then vanished beneath the emerald waves. The Spartans hung there a moment, waiting and watching with their assault rifles trained on the water. No survivors surfaced. They rappelled down to the beach and rendezvoused with Blue 2 and 4. "Red team reports mission objective achieved, Chief," Blue 2 said. "They send their compliments."
"It's hardly going to balance the scales," Blue 3 muttered and kicked the sand. "Not like those grunts when they slaughtered the 105th dropjet platoon. They should suffer just as much as those guys did."
The chief had nothing to say to that. It wasn't his job to make things suffer. He was just here to win battles, whatever it took.
"Blue 2," the chief said, "get me an uplink."
"Aye, aye."
She patched him into the SATCOM system.
"Mission accomplished, Captain DeBlanc," the chief reported. "Enemy neutralized."
"Excellent news," the captain said.
He sighed and added,
"But we're pulling you out, Chief."
"We were just getting warmed up down here, sir."
"Well, it's a different story up here. Move out for pickup ASAP.
"Understood, sir."
The chief killed the uplink. He told his team,
"The party's over, Spartans. Dust off in 15.
They jogged double-quick up the 10 kilometers of the beach and returned to their dropship. A Pelican, scuffed and dented from 3 days' hard fighting. They boarded, and the ship's engines whined to life. Blue 2 took off her helmet and scratched the stubble of her brown hair.
"It's a shame to leave this place," she said, and leaned against the porthole. "There are so few left."
The chief stood by her and glanced out as they lifted into the air. There were wide, rolling plains of palm grass, the green expanse of ocean, a wispy band of clouds in the sky, and setting red suns.
"There will be other places to fight for," he said.
"Will there?"
she whispered.
The Pelican ascended rapidly through the atmosphere. The sky darkened, and soon only stars surrounded them. In orbit, there were dozens of frigates, destroyers, and 2 massive carriers. Every ship had carbon scoring and holes peppering their hulls. They were all maneuvering to break orbit. They docked in the port bay of the UNSC destroyer Resolute. Despite being surrounded by 2 meters of titanium A battle plate and an array of modern weapons, the chief preferred to have his feet on the ground with real gravity and real atmosphere to breathe, a place where he was in control, and where his life wasn't held in the hands of anonymous pilots. A ship just wasn't home. The battlefield was. The chief rode the elevator to the bridge to make his report, taking advantage of the momentary respite to read Red Team's after-action report in his display. As predicted, the Spartans of Red, Blue, and Green Teams, augmenting 3 divisions of battle-hardened UNSC Marines, had stalled a Covenant ground advance. Casualty figures were still coming in, but on the ground at least, the alien forces had been completely stonewalled. A moment later, the lift doors parted, and he stepped on the rubberized deck. He snapped a crisp salute to Captain DeBlanc.
"Sir, reporting is ordered."
The junior bridge officers took a step back from the chief. They weren't used to seeing a Spartan in full Mjolnir armor up close. Most line troops had never even seen a Spartan. The ghostly iridescent green of the armor plates and the matte black layers underneath made him look part gladiator, part machine. Or perhaps to the bridge crew, he looked as alien as the Covenant. The view screen showed stars and Jericho 7's four silver moons. At extreme range, a small constellation of stars drifted closer. The captain waved the chief closer as he stared at that cluster of stars, the rest of the battle group.
"It's happening again."
"Request permission to remain on the bridge, sir," the chief said. "I want to see it this time, sir."
The captain hung his head, looking weary. He glanced at the Master Chief with haunted eyes.
"Very well, Chief. After all you've been through to save Jericho 7, we owe you that. We're only 30 million kilometers out-system, though, not half as far as I'd like to be."
He turned to the nav officer.
"Bearing 120, prepare our exit vector."
He turned to face the Chief.
"We'll stay to watch, but if those bastards so much as twitch in our direction, we're jumping the hell out of here."
"Understood, sir. Thank you."
Resolute's engines rumbled, and the ship moved off. 3 dozen Covenant ships, big ones, destroyers and cruisers, winked into view in the system. They were sleek, looking more like sharks than StarCraft. Their lateral lines brightened with plasma, then discharged and rained fire down upon Jericho 7. The chief watched for an hour and didn't move a muscle. The planet's lakes, rivers, and oceans vaporized. By tomorrow, the atmosphere would boil away too. Fields and forests were glassy smooth and glowing red-hot in patches. Where there had once been a paradise, only hell remained.
"Make ready to jump clear of the system,"
the captain ordered. The chief continued to watch, his face grim. There had been 10 years of this. The vast network of human colonies whittled down to a handful of strongholds by a merciless, implacable enemy. The chief had killed the enemy on the ground, shot them, stabbed them, and broken them with his own 2 hands. On the ground, the Spartans always won. The problem was, the Spartans couldn't take their fight into space. Every minor victory on the ground turned into a major defeat in orbit. Soon, there would be no more colonies, no human settlements, and nowhere left to run. Section 1. Reveille. Chapter 1. 0430 hours. August 17th, 2517, military calendar. Slipstream space, unknown coordinates, near Eridanus star system. Lieutenant Junior Grade Jacob Keyes awoke. Dull red light filled his blurry vision, and he choked on the slime in his lungs and throat.
"Sit up, Lieutenant Keyes," a disembodied male voice said. "Sit. Take a deep breath and cough, sir. You need to clear the bronchial surfactant."
Lieutenant Keyes pushed himself up, peeling his back off the form-fitting gel bed. Wisps of fog overflowed from the cryogenic tube as he clumsily climbed out. He sat on a nearby bench, tried to inhale, and doubled over, coughing until a long string of clear fluid flowed from his open mouth. He sat up and drew his first full breath in 2 weeks. He tasted his lips and almost gagged. The cryo-inhalant was specially designed to be regurgitated and swallowed, replacing nutrients lost in the deep sleep. No matter how they changed the formula, though, it always tasted like lime-flavored mucus.
"Status, Torin. We under attack?"
"Negative, sir," the ship's AI replied. "Status normal. We will enter normal space near the Eridanus system in 45 minutes.
Lieutenant Keyes coughed again.
"Good. Thank you, Torin."
"You're welcome, Lieutenant."
Eridanus was on the border of the Outer Colonies. It was just far enough off the beaten path for pirates to be lurking, waiting to capture a diplomatic shuttle like the Han. This ship wouldn't last long in a space action.
They should have an escort. He didn't understand why they had been sent alone, but junior lieutenants didn't question orders, especially when those orders came from Fleet Comm HQ on Planet Reach.
Wake-up protocols dictated that he inspect the rest of the crew to make sure no one had run into problems reviving. He looked around the sleep chamber. Rows of stainless steel lockers and showers. A medical pod for emergency resuscitations. And 40 cryogenic tubes. All empty, except the one to his left. The other person on the Han was the civilian specialist, Dr. Halsey. Keyes had been ordered to protect her at all costs, pilot this ship, and generally stay the hell out of her way. They might as well have asked him to hold her hand. This wasn't a military mission, it was babysitting. Someone at Fleet Command must have him on their blacklist. The cover of Dr. Halsey's tube hummed open. Mist rippled out as she sat up, coughing. Her pale skin made her look like a ghost in the fog. Matted locks of dark hair clung to her neck. She didn't look much older than him, and she was lovely. Not beautiful, but definitely a striking woman. For a civilian, anyway. Her blue eyes fixed upon the lieutenant, and she looked him over.
"We must be near Eridanus," she said.
Lieutenant Keyes almost saluted reflectively, but checked the motion.
"Yes, doctor."
His face reddened, and he looked away from her slender body. He had drilled in cryogenic recovery a dozen times at the academy. He'd seen his fellow officers naked before, men and women. But Dr. Halsey was a civilian. He didn't know what protocols applied. Lieutenant Keyes got up and went to her.
"Can I help you?"
She swung her legs out of the tube and climbed out.
"I'm fine, Lieutenant. Get cleaned up and dressed."
She brushed past him and strode to the showers.
"Hurry. We have important work to do."
Lieutenant Keyes stood straighter.
"Aye, aye, ma'am."
With that brief encounter, their roles and the rules of conduct crystallized. Civilian or not, like it or not, Lieutenant Keyes understood that Dr. Halsey was in charge. The bridge of the Han had an abundance of space for a vessel of its size. That is, it had all the maneuvering room of a walk-in closet. A freshly showered, shaved, and uniformed Lieutenant Keyes pulled himself into the room and sealed the pressure door behind him. Every surface of the bridge was covered with monitors and screens. The wall on his left was a single large semi-curved view screen, dark for the moment, because there was nothing in the visible spectrum to see in slipspace. Behind him was the Han's spinning center section, containing the mess, the rec room, and the sleep chambers. There was no gravity on the bridge, however. The diplomatic shuttle had been designed for the comfort of its passengers, not the crew. It didn't seem to bother Dr. Halsey. Strapped into the navigator's couch, she wore a white jumpsuit that matched her pale skin, and had tied her dark hair into a simple, elegant knot. Her fingers danced across four keypads, tapping in commands.
"Welcome, Lieutenant," she said without looking up. "Please have a seat at the communication station and monitor the channels when we enter normal space. If there's so much as a squeak on non-standard frequencies, I want to know instantly."
He drifted to the communication station and strapped himself down.
"Torin?"
she asked. "Awaiting your orders, Dr. Halsey," the ship AI replied.
"Give me astrogation maps of the system."
"Online, Dr. Halsey."
"Are there any planets currently aligned with our entry trajectory in Eridanus II? I want to pick up a gravitational boost so we can move in system ASAP."
"Calculating now, Dr. Hull."
"And can we have some music? Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3, I think."
"Understood, Doctor."
"And start a pre-burn warm-up cycle for the fusion engines."
"Yes, Doc."
"And stop spinning the Han's central carousel section. We may need the power."
"Working." She eased back. The music started, and she sighed.
"Thank you, Torin."
"You're welcome, Dr. Halsey. Entering normal space in 5 minutes, plus or minus 3 minutes." Lieutenant Keyes shot the doctor an admiring glance. He was impressed. Few people could put a shipboard AI through its paces so rigorously as to cause a detectable pause. She turned to face him.
"Yes, Lieutenant, you have a question?"
He composed himself and pulled his uniform jacket taut.
"I was curious about our mission, ma'am. I assume we are to reconnoiter something in this system, but why send a shuttle rather than a prowler or a corvette? And why just the two of us?"
She blinked and smiled.
A fairly accurate assumption and analysis, Lieutenant. This is a reconnaissance mission, of sorts. We are here to observe a child. The first of many, I hope.
A child?
A 6-year-old male, to be precise. She waved her hand. It may help if you think of this purely as a UNSC-funded physiological study.
Every trace of a smile evaporated from her lips.
Which is precisely what you are to tell anyone who asks. Is that understood, Lieutenant?
Yes, Doctor.
Keyes frowned, retrieved his grandfather's pipe from his pocket, and turned it end over end. He couldn't smoke the thing. Igniting a combustible on the flight deck was against every major regulation on a UNSC space vehicle, but sometimes he just fiddled with it or chewed on the tip, which helped him think. He stuck it back into his pocket and decided to push the issue and find out more.
With all due respect, Dr. Halsey, this sector of space is dangerous.
With a sudden deceleration, they entered normal space. The main view screen flickered and a million stars snapped into focus. The Han dove toward a cloud-swirled gas giant dead ahead.
"Stand by for burn," Dr. Halsey announced. "On my mark, Torin."
Lieutenant Keyes tightened his harness.
3, 2, 1, mark.
The ship rumbled and sped faster toward the gas giant. The pull of the harness increased around the lieutenant's chest, making breathing difficult. They accelerated for 67 seconds. The storms of the gas giant grew larger on the viewscreen. Then the Han arced up and away from its surface. Eridanus drifted into the center of the screen and filled the bridge with warm orange light. "Gravity boost complete," Torin chimed. "ETA to Eridanus is 42 minutes, 3 seconds.
"Well done,"
Dr. Halsey said. She unlocked her harness and floated free, stretching.
"I hate cryo-sleep," she said. "It leaves one so cramped.
As I was saying before, Doctor, this system is dangerous."
She gracefully spun to face him, halting her momentum with a hand on the bulkhead.
"Oh, yes, I know how dangerous this system is. It has a colorful history. Rebel insurrection in 2494, beaten down by the UNSC 2 years later at the cost of 4 destroyers.'
She thought a moment, then added,
"I don't believe the Office of Naval Intelligence ever found their base in the asteroid field. And since there have been organized raids and scattered pirate activity nearby, one might conclude, as ONI clearly has, that the remnants of the original rebel faction are still active. Is that what you were worried about?"
Yes, the lieutenant replied.
He swallowed, his mouth suddenly dry. But he refused to be cowed by the doctor, by a civilian.
"I need hardly remind you that it's my job to worry about our security."
She knew more than he did, much more, about the Eridanus system, and she obviously had contacts in the intelligence community. Keyes had never seen an ONI spook, to the best of his knowledge, anyway. Mainline Navy personnel had elevated such agents to near mythological status. Whatever else he thought of Dr. Halsey, he would assume from now on that she knew what she was doing. Dr. Halsey stretched once more and then strapped herself back onto the navigation couch.
"Speaking of pirates," she said, with her back now to him, "weren't you supposed to be monitoring communication channels for illegal signals? Just in case someone takes undue interest in a lone, unescorted diplomatic shuttle?"
Lieutenant Keyes cursed himself for his momentary lapse and snapped to. He scanned all frequencies and had Torin cross-check their authentication codes.
"All signals verified," he reported. "No pirate transmissions detected.
Continue to monitor them, please."
An awkward 30 minutes passed. Dr. Halsey was content to read reports on the navigational screens and kept her back to him. Lieutenant Keyes finally cleared his throat.
May I speak candidly, Doctor?"
"You don't need my permission," she said. "By all means, speak candidly, Lieutenant. You've been doing a fine job so far."
Under normal circumstances, among normal officers, that last remark would have been insubordination, or worse, a rebuke. But he let it pass. Normal military protocols seemed to have been jettisoned on this flight.
You said we were here to observe a child. He shook his head dubiously. If this is a cover for real military intelligence work, then to tell the truth, there are better qualified officers for this mission. I graduated from UNSC OCS only 7 weeks ago. My orders had me rotated to the Magellan. Those orders were rescinded, ma'am.
She turned and scrutinized him with icy blue eyes.
Go on, Lieutenant.
He reached for his pipe, but then checked the motion. She would probably think it a silly habit.
If this is an intel op, he said, then I don't understand why I'm here at all.
She leaned forward. Then, Lieutenant, I shall be equally candid. Something deep inside Lieutenant Keyes told him he would regret hearing whatever Dr. Halsey had to say. He ignored the feeling. He wanted to know the truth.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Her slight smile returned.
You are here because Vice Admiral Stanforth, head of Section 3 of UNSC Military Intelligence Division, refused to lend me this shuttle without at least one UNSC officer aboard, even though he knows damn well that I can pilot this bucket by myself. So I picked one UNSC officer. You.
She tapped her lower lip thoughtfully and added,
You see, I've read your file, Lieutenant. All of it.
I don't know.
You do know what I'm talking about. She rolled her eyes. You don't lie well. Don't insult me by trying again.
Lieutenant Keyes swallowed.
Then why me? Especially if you've seen my record. I chose you precisely because of your record. Because of the incident in your second year at OCS. 14 ensigns killed. You were wounded and spent 2 months in rehabilitation. Plasma burns are particularly painful, I understand.
He rubbed his hands together.
Yes. The lieutenant responsible was your CO on that training mission. You refused to testify against him despite overwhelming evidence and the testimony of his fellow officers and friends.
Yes.
They told the Board of Review the secret the lieutenant had entrusted to you all, that he was going to test his new theory to make slipspace jumps more accurate. He was wrong, and you all paid for his eagerness and poor mathematics.
Lieutenant Keyes studied his hands and had the feeling of falling inward. Dr. Halsey's voice sounded distant.
Yes. Despite continuing pressure, you never testified. They threatened to demote you, charge you with insubordination and refusing a direct order, even discharge you from the Navy. Your fellow officer candidates testified, though. The review board had all the evidence they needed to court-martial your CO. They put you on report and dropped all further disciplinary actions.
He said nothing. His head hung low.
That is why you are here, Lieutenant. Because you have an ability that is exceedingly rare in the military. You can keep a secret.
She drew in a long breath and added,
You may have to keep many secrets after this mission is over.
He glanced up. There was a strange look in her eyes.
Pity?
That caught him off guard, and he looked away again. But he felt better than he had since OCS. Someone trusted him again.
I think, she said, that you would rather be on the Magellan, fighting and dying on the frontier.
No, I... He caught the lie as he said it, stopped, then corrected himself.
Yes. The UNSC needs every man and woman patrolling the outer colonies. Between the raiders and insurrections, it's a wonder it all hasn't fallen apart.
Indeed, Lieutenant. Ever since we left Earth's gravity well, we've been fighting one another for every cubic centimeter of vacuum. From Mars, to the Hovian moons, to the Hydra system massacres, and on to the 100 brushfire wars in the outer colonies. It has always been on the brink of falling apart. That's why we're here.
To observe one child, he said.
What difference could a child make?
One of her eyebrows arched.
This child could be more useful to the UNSC than a fleet of destroyers, 1,000 junior grade lieutenants, or even me. In the end, the child may be the only thing that makes any difference.
Approaching Eridanus II, Torrin informed them.
Plot an atmospheric vector for the Luxor spaceport,
Dr. Halsey ordered.
Lieutenant Keyes, make ready to land.
Chapter 2 1130 hours, August 17, 2517, military calendar. Eridanus Star System, Eridanus 2, Elysium City. The orange sun cast a fiery glow on the playground of Elysium City Primary Education Facility number 119. Dr. Halsey and Lieutenant Keyes stood in the semi-shade of a canvas awning and watched children as they screamed and chased one another and climbed on steel lattices and skimmed grav balls across the repulsor courts. Lieutenant Keyes looked extremely uncomfortable in civilian clothes. He wore a loose gray suit, a white shirt, and no tie. Dr. Halsey found his sudden awkwardness charming. When he had complained the clothes were too loose and sloppy, she had almost laughed. He was pure military to the core. Even out of uniform, the lieutenant stood rigid, as if he were at perpetual attention. "It's nice here," she said. "This colony doesn't know how good they've got it. Rural lifestyle, no pollution, no crowding, climate-controlled weather." The lieutenant grunted an acknowledgement as he tried to smooth the wrinkles out of his silk jacket. "Relax," she said. "We're supposed to be parents inspecting the school for our little girl." She slipped her arm through his, and although she would have thought such a feat impossible, the lieutenant stood even straighter. She sighed and pulled away from him, opened her purse, and retrieved a palm-sized pad. She adjusted the brim of her wide straw hat to shade the pad from the noon glare. With a tap of her finger, she accessed and scanned the file she had assembled of their subject. Number 117 had all the genetic markers she had flagged in her original study. He was as close to a perfect subject for her purposes as science could determine. But Dr. Halsey knew it would take more than theoretical perfection to make this project work. People were more than the sum of their genes. There were environmental factors, mutations, learned ethics, and 100 other factors that could make this candidate unacceptable. The picture in the file showed a typical 6-year-old male. He had tousled brown hair and a sly grin that revealed a gap between his front teeth. A few freckles were speckled across his cheeks. Good. She could match the patterns to confirm his identity. "Our subject." As she angled the pad toward the lieutenant so he could see the boy, Dr. Halsey noticed that the picture was 4 months old. Didn't Owen and I realize how fast these children changed? Sloppy. She made a note to request updated pictures on a regular basis until Phase 3 started. "Is that him?" the lieutenant whispered. Dr. Halsey looked up. The lieutenant nodded to a grassy hill at the end of the playground. The crest of that hill was bare dirt, scuffed clean of all vegetation. A dozen boys pushed and shoved one another, grabbed, tackled, rolled down the slope, and then got back up, ran back, and started the process over. "King of the hill," Dr. Halsey remarked. One boy stood on the crest. He blocked, pushed, and strong-armed all the other children. Dr. Halsey pointed her data pad at him and recorded this incident for later study. She zoomed in on the subject to get a better look. This boy smiled and showed the same small gap between his front teeth. A split-second freeze frame and she matched his freckles to the picture on file. "That's our boy." He was taller than the other children by a full head, and, if his performance in the game was any indicator, stronger as well. Another boy grabbed him from behind in a headlock. Number 117 peeled the boy off and, with a laugh, tossed him down the hillside like a toy. Dr. Halsey had expected a specimen of perfect physical proportions and stunning intellect. True, the subject was strong and fast, but he was also dirty and rude. Then again, unrealistic and subjective perceptions had to be confronted in these field studies. What did she really expect? He was a 6-year-old boy, full of life and unchecked emotion, and as predictable as the wind. 3 boys ganged up on him. 2 grabbed his legs and 1 threw his arm around his chest. They all tumbled down the hill. Number 117 kicked and punched and bit his attackers until they let go and ran away to a safe distance. He rose and tore back up the hill, bumping another boy and shouting that he was king. "He seems," the lieutenant started,
Very animated.
Yes, Dr. Halsey said. We may be able to use this one. She glanced up and down the playground. The only adult was helping a girl get to her feet after falling down and scraping her elbow. She marched her towards the nurse's office.
Stay here and watch me, Lieutenant, she said and passed him the data pad. I'm going to have a closer look.
The lieutenant started to say something, but Dr. Halsey walked away, then half-jogged across the painted lines of hopscotch squares on the playground. A breeze caught her sundress, and she had to clutch the hem with one hand, grabbing the brim of her straw hat with the other. She slowed to a trot and halted 4 meters from the base of the hill. The children stopped and turned.
You're in trouble,
one boy said, and pushed number 117. He shoved the boy back and then looked Dr. Halsey squarely in the eyes. The other children looked away. Some wore embarrassed smirks, and a few slowly backed off. Her subject, however, stood there defiantly. He was either confident she wasn't going to punish him, or he simply wasn't afraid. He saw that he had a bruise on his cheek, the knees of his pants were torn, and his lip was cracked. Dr. Halsey took 3 steps closer. Several of the children took 3 involuntary steps backward.
"Can I speak with you, please?"
she asked, and continued to stare at her subject. He finally broke eye contact, shrugged, and then lumbered down the hill. The other children giggled and made tisking sounds. One tossed a pebble at him. Number 117 ignored them. Dr. Halsey led him to the edge of the nearby sand pit and stopped.
"What's your name?" she asked.
"I'm John,"
he said. The boy held out his hand. Dr. Halsey didn't expect physical contact. The subject's father must have taught him the ritual, or the boy was highly imitative. She shook his hand and was surprised by the strength in his minuscule grip.
"It's very nice to meet you."
She knelt, so she was at his level.
"I wanted to ask what you were doing."
"Winning!" he said.
Dr. Halsey smiled. He was unafraid of her, and she doubted that he'd have any trouble pushing her off the hill either.
"You like games," she said. "So do I."
He sighed.
"Yeah, but they made me play chess last week. That got boring. It's too easy to win."
He took a quick breath.
"Or can we play grab ball? They don't let me play grab ball anymore, but maybe if you tell them it's okay."
"I have a different game I want you to try," she told him. "Look."
She reached into her purse and brought out a metal disc. She turned it over and it gleamed in the sun.
"People used coins like this for currency a long time ago, when Earth was the only planet we lived on."
His eyes fixed on the object. He reached for it. Dr. Halsey moved it away, continuing to flip it between her thumb and index finger.
"Each side is different, do you see? One has the face of a man with long hair. The other side has a bird called an eagle, and it's holding..."
"Arrows,"
John said.
"Yes, good."
His eyesight must be exceptional to see such detail so far away.
"We'll use this coin in our game. If you win, you can keep it."
John tore his gaze from the coin and looked at her again, squinted, then said,
"Okay. I always win, though. That's why they won't let me play grab ball anymore."
"I'm sure you do."
"What's the game?"
"It's very simple. I toss the coin like this."
She flicked her wrist, snapped her thumb, and the coin arced, spinning into the air and landed in the sand.
"Next time, though, before it lands, I want you to tell me if it will fall with the face of the man showing, or with the eagle holding the arrows."
"I got it."
John tensed, bent his knees, and then his eyes seemed to lose their focus on her and the coin. Dr. Halsey picked up the quarter.
"Ready?"
John gave a slight nod. She tossed it, making sure there was plenty of spin. John's eyes watched it with that strange, distant gaze. He tracked it as it went up and then down toward the ground. His hands snapped out and snatched the quarter out of the air. He held up his closed hand.
"Eagle!"
he shouted. She tentatively reached for his hand and peeled open the tiny fist. The quarter lay in his palm, the eagle shining in the orange sun. Was it possible that he saw which side was up when he grabbed it? Or more improbably, could have picked which side he wanted? She hoped the lieutenant had recorded that. She should have told him to keep the data pad trained on her. John retracted his hand.
I get to keep it, right? That's what you said.
Yes, you can keep it, John. She smiled at him, then stopped. She shouldn't have used his name. That was a bad sign. She couldn't afford the luxury of liking her test subjects. She mentally stepped away from her feelings. She had to maintain a professional distance. She had to, because in a few months, number 117 might not be alive.
Can we play again?
Dr. Halsey stood and took a step back. That was the only one I had, I'm afraid. I have to leave now, she told him. Go back and play with your friends.
Thanks.
He ran back, shouting to the other boys.
Look!
Dr. Halsey strode to the lieutenant. The sun reflecting off the asphalt felt too hot, and she suddenly didn't want to be outside. She wanted to be back in the ship, where it was cool and dark. She wanted to get off this planet. She stepped under the canvas awning and said to the lieutenant, "Tell me you recorded that." He handed her the data pad and looked puzzled. "Yes. What was it all about?" Dr. Halsey checked the recording and then sent a copy ahead to Torin on the Han for safekeeping. "We screen these subjects for certain genetic markers," she said. "Strength, agility, even predispositions for aggression and intellect. But we couldn't remote test for everything. We don't test for luck."
"Luck?" Lieutenant Keyes asked.
"You believe in luck, Doctor?"
"Of course not," she said with a dismissive wave of her hand. "But we have 150 test subjects to consider, and facilities and funding for only half that number."
"It's simple mathematical elimination, Lieutenant. That child was one of the lucky ones. Either that, or he is extraordinarily fast. Either way, he's in."
"I don't understand," Lieutenant Keyes said, and he started fiddling with a pipe he carried in his pocket.
"I hope that continues, Lieutenant," Dr. Halsey replied quietly. "For your sake, I hope you never understand what we're doing." She looked one last time at number 117, at John. He was having so much fun, running and laughing. For a moment she envied the boy's innocence. Hers was long dead. Life or death, lucky or not, she was condemning this boy to a great deal of pain and suffering. But it had to be done.
Chapter 3 2300 Hours, September 23rd, 2517, Military Calendar. Epsilon Eridani System, Reach Military Complex, Planet Reach. Dr. Halsey stood on a platform in the center of the amphitheater. Concentric rings of slate-gray risers surrounded her, empty for now. Overhead spotlights focused and reflected off her white lab coat, but she was still cold. She should feel safe here. Reach was one of the UNSC's largest industrial bases, ringed with high-orbit gun batteries, space docks, and a fleet of heavily armed capital ships. On the planet's surface were Marine and Navy Special Warfare Training Grounds, OCS schools, and between her underground facilities and the surface were 300 meters of hardened steel and concrete. The room where she now stood could withstand a direct hit from an 80-megaton nuke. So why did she feel so vulnerable? Dr. Halsey knew what she had to do. Her duty. It was for the greater good. All humanity would be served, even if a tiny handful of them had to suffer for it. Still, when she turned inward and faced her complicity in this, she was revolted by what she saw. She wished she still had Lieutenant Keyes. He had proven himself a capable assistant during the last month, but he had begun to understand the nature of the project, at least seen the edges of the truth. Dr. Halsey had him reassigned to the Magellan with a commission to full lieutenant for his troubles.
"Are you ready, Doctor?"
a disembodied woman's voice asked.
Almost, Asia, Dr. Halsey sighed. Please summon Chief Petty Officer Mendez. I'd like you both present when I address them.
Deja's hologram flicked on next to Dr. Halsey. The AI had been specifically created for Dr. Halsey's Spartan project. She took the appearance of a Greek goddess, barefoot, wrapped in the toga, motes of light dancing about her luminous white hair. She held a clay tablet in her left hand. Binary cuneiform markings scrolled across the tablet. Dr. Halsey couldn't help but marvel at the AI's chosen form. Each AI self-assigned a holographic appearance, and each was unique. One of the doors at the top of the amphitheater opened, and Chief Petty Officer Mendez strode down the stairs. He wore a black dress uniform, his chest awash with silver and gold stars and a rainbow of campaign ribbons. His close-shorn hair had a touch of gray at the temples. He was neither tall nor muscular. He looked so ordinary for a man who had seen so much combat, except for his stride. The man moved with a slow grace, as if he were walking in half-gravity. He paused before Dr. Halsey, awaiting further instructions.
"Up here, please,"
she told him, gesturing to the stairs on her right. Mendez mounted the stairs of the platform and then stood at ease next to her.
"You have read my psychological evaluations?"
Deja asked Dr. Halsey.
"Yes, they were quite thorough," she said. "Thank you." "And?"
"I'm forgoing your recommendations, Deja. I'm going to tell them the truth."
Mendez gave a nearly inaudible grunt of approval, one of the most verbose acknowledgments Dr. Halsey had heard from him. As a hand-to-hand combat and physical training NCO, Mendez was the best in the Navy. As a conversationalist, however, he left a great deal to be desired.
"The truth has risks," Deja cautioned.
"So do lies," Dr. Halsey replied. "Any story fabricated to motivate the children, claiming their parents were taken and killed by pirates or by a plague that devastated their planet, if they learned the truth later, they would turn against us."
"It's a legitimate concern," conceded Deja, and then she consulted her tablet. "May I suggest selective neural paralysis? It produces a targeted amnesia,
a memory loss that may leak into other parts of the brain."
"No,"
Dr. Halsey said.
"This will be dangerous enough for them, even with intact minds."
Dr. Halsey clicked on her microphone.
"Bring them in now."
"Aye, aye,"
a voice replied from the speakers in the ceiling.
"They'll adapt,"
Dr. Halsey told Deja.
"Or they won't, and they will be untrainable and unsuitable for the project. Either way, I just want to get this over with."
Four sets of double doors at the top tier of the amphitheater swung open. 75 children marched in, each accompanied by a handler, a naval drill instructor in camouflage pattern fatigues. The children had circles of fatigue around their eyes. They had all been collected, rushed here through slipstream space, and only recently brought out of cryosleep. The shock of the ordeal must be hitting them hard, Halsey realized. She stifled a pang of regret. When they had been seated in the risers, Dr. Halsey cleared her throat and spoke.
"As per Naval Code 25812, you are hereby conscripted into the UNSC Special Project, codenamed Spartan II.
She paused, the words stuck in her windpipe. How could they possibly understand this? She barely understood the justifications and ethics behind this program.
They looked so confused.
A few tried to stand and leave, but their handlers placed firm hands on their shoulders and pushed them back down.
6 years old.
This was too much for them to digest. But she had to make them understand, explain it in simple terms that they could grasp. Dr. Halsey took a tentative step forward.
"You have been called upon to serve," she explained. "You will be trained, and you will become the best we can make of you. You will be the protectors of Earth and all her colonies."
A handful of the children sat up straighter, no longer entirely frightened, but now interested. Dr. Halsey spotted John, subject number 117, the first boy she had confirmed as a viable candidate. He wrinkled his forehead, confused, but he listened with rapt attention.
"This will be hard to understand, but you cannot return to your parents."
The children stirred. Their handlers kept a firm grip on their shoulders.
"This place will become your home,"
Dr. Halsey said in as soothing a voice as she could muster.
"Your fellow trainees will be your family now. The training will be difficult. There will be a great deal of hardship on the road ahead, but I know you will all make it."
Patriotic words, but they rang hollow in her ears. She had wanted to tell them the truth, but how could she? Not all of them would make it.
"Acceptable losses," the Office of Naval Intelligence representative had assured her. None of it was acceptable.
"Rest now," Dr. Halsey said to them. "We begin tomorrow."
She turned to Mendez.
"Have the children, the trainees, escorted to their barracks. Feed them and put them to bed."
"Yes, ma'am," Mendez said.
"Fall out!"
he shouted. The children rose, at the urging of their handlers. John 117 stood, but he kept his gaze on Dr. Halsey and remained stoic. Many of the subjects seemed stunned. A few had trembling lips, but none of them cried. These were indeed the right children for the project. Dr. Halsey only hoped that she had half their courage when the time came.
"Keep them busy tomorrow," she told Mendez and Deja. "Keep them from thinking about what we've just done to them."
Section 2. Boot. Chapter 4. 0530 hours, September 24th, 2517, military calendar. Epsilon Eridani system. Reach military complex. Planet Reach.
"Wake up, trainee!"
John rolled over in his cot and went back to sleep. He was dimly aware that this wasn't his room, and that there were other people here. A shock jolted him, from his bare feet to the base of his spine. He yelled in surprise and fell off the cot. He shook off the disorientation from being nearly asleep, and got up.
"I set up, Boot! You know which way up is?"
A man in a camouflage uniform stood over John. His hair was shorn and gray at his temples. His dark eyes didn't look human. Too big and black, and they didn't blink. He held a silver baton in one hand. He flicked it toward John, and it sparked. John backed away. He wasn't afraid of anything. Only little kids were afraid. But his body instinctively moved as far away from the instrument as possible. Dozens of other men roused the rest of the children. 74 boys and girls screamed and jumped out of their cots.
"I am Chief Petty Officer Mendez,"
the uniformed man next to John shouted.
"The rest of these men are your instructors. You will do exactly as we tell you at all times."
Mendez pointed to the far end of the cinder-block barracks.
"Showers are aft! You will all wash and then return here to dress."
He opened a trunk at the foot of John's cot and pulled out a matching set of gray sweats. John leaned closer and saw his name stenciled on the chest. John 117.
"No slacking, on the double!"
Mendez tapped John between his shoulder blades with a baton. Lightning surged across John's chest. He sprawled on the cot and gasped for breath.
"I mean it! Go, go, go!"
John moved. He couldn't inhale, but he ran anyway, clutching his chest. He managed a ragged breath by the time he got to the showers. The other kids looked scared and disoriented. They all stripped off their nightshirts and stepped onto the conveyor, washed themselves in lukewarm soapy water, then rinsed in an icy cold spray. He ran back to his bunk, got into underwear, thick socks, pulled on the sweats and a pair of combat boots that fit his feet perfectly.
"Outside, trainees! Triple time! March!"
John and the others stampeded out of the barracks onto a strip of grass. The sun hadn't risen yet, and the edge of the sky was indigo. The grass was wet with dew. There were dozens of rows of barracks, but no one else was up and outside. A pair of jets roared overhead and arced up into the sky. Far away, John heard a metallic crackle. Chief Petty Officer Mendez barked,
"You will make 5 equal-length rows, 15 trainees in each.
He waited a few seconds as they milled about.
"Straighten those rows! You know how to count to 15, trainee? Take 3 steps back!"
John stepped into the second row. As he breathed the cold air, he began to wake up. He started to remember. They had taken him in the middle of the night. They injected him with something, and he slept for a long time. Then the woman who had given him the coin told him he couldn't go back, that he wouldn't see his mother or father.
"Jumping jacks!"
Mendez shouted.
"Count off to 100! Ready? Go!"
The officer started the exercise, and John followed his lead. One boy refused, for a split second. An instructor was on him instantly. The baton whipped into the boy's stomach. The kid doubled over.
"Get with the program, boot!"
the trainer snarled. The boy uncurled and started jumping. John had never done so many jumping jacks in his life. His arms and stomach and legs burned. Sweat trickled down his back.
98, 99, 100!
Mendez paused. He drew in a deep breath.
"Sit-ups!"
He dropped onto the grass.
"Count off to 100! No slacking!"
John threw himself on the ground.
"The first crewman who quits,"
Mendez said,
"gets to run around the compound twice and then comes back here and does 200 sit-ups. Ready, count off! 1, 2, 3!
Deep squats followed, then knee bends. John threw up, but that didn't buy him any respite. A trainer descended on him after a few seconds. John rolled back over and continued.
"Leg lifts!"
Mendez continued like he was a machine, as if they were all machines. John couldn't go on, but he knew he'd get the baton again if he stopped. He tried. He had to move. His legs trembled and only sluggishly responded.
"Rest!"
Mendez finally called.
"Trainers, get the water!"
The trainers wheeled out carts laden with water bottles. John grabbed one and gulped down the liquid. It was warm and slightly salty. He didn't care. It was the best water he'd ever had. He flopped on his back in the grass and panted. The sun was up now. It was warm. He rolled to his knees and let the sweat drip off him like a heavy rain. He slowly got up and glanced at the other children. They crouched on the ground, holding their sides, and no one talked. Their clothes were soaked through with perspiration. John didn't recognize anyone from his school here. So he was alone with strangers. He wondered where his mother was, and what...
"A good start, trainees,"
Mendez told them.
"Now we run! On your feet!"
The trainers brandished their batons and herded the trainees along. They jogged down a gravel path through the compound, past more cinder-block barracks. The run seemed to go on forever. They ran alongside a river, over a bridge, then by the edge of a runway where jets took off straight into the air. Once past the runway, Mendez led them on a zigzagging path of stone. John wanted to think about what had happened, how he got here, and what was going to happen next, but he couldn't think straight. All he could feel was the blood pounding through him, the ache in his muscles, and hunger. They ran into a courtyard of smooth flagstones. A pole in the center flew the colors of the UNSC, a blue field with stars and earth in the corner. At the far end of the yard was a building with a scalloped dome and white columns and dozens of wide steps leading to the entrance. The words, "Naval Officers Academy," were chiseled into the arch over the entrance. A woman stood on the top step and beckoned to them. She wore a white sheet wrapped around her body. She looked old to John, yet young at the same time. Then he saw the motes of light orbiting her head and knew she was an AI. He had seen them on vids. She wasn't solid, but she was still real.
"Excellent work, Chief Petty Officer Mendez," she said in a resonant, silk-smooth voice. She turned to the children. "Welcome. My name is Deja, and I will be your teacher. Please come in. Class is about to start."
John groaned out loud. Several of the others grumbled, too. She turned and started to walk inside.
Of course, she said. If you prefer to skip your lessons, you may continue the morning calisthenics.
John double-timed it up the steps.
It was cool inside. A tray with crackers and a carton of milk had been laid out for each of them.
John nibbled on the dry, stale food, then gulped down his milk. John was so tired he wanted to lay his head down on the desk and take a nap, until Deja started to tell them about a battle and how 300 soldiers fought against thousands of Persian infantry. A holographic countryside appeared in the classroom. The children walked around the miniature mountains and hills and let the edge of the illusionary sea lap at their boots. Toy soldiers marched toward what Deja explained was Thermopylae, a narrow strip of land between steep mountains and the sea. Thousands of soldiers marched toward the 300 who guarded the pass. The soldiers fought. Spears and shields splintered. Swords flashed and spilled blood. John couldn't take his eyes off the spectacle. Deja explained that the 300 were Spartans, and they were the best soldiers who had ever lived. They had been trained to fight since they were children. No one could beat them. John watched, fascinated, as the holographic Spartans slaughtered the Persians.